Hello, my name is Lalani Gorm. For today's podcast episode, I'll be interviewing Ms. Melissa McCaw. Her appointment in January of 2019 made her the first African-American woman to serve as a secretary in the Office of Policy and Management in Governor Ned Lamont's cabinet. She was effectively the highest-ranking financial advisor in the cabinet. She was tasked with overseeing labor negotiations and policy initiatives in addition to the state budget. Currently, she is serving as a director of finance in the town of East Hartford and is responsible for overseeing the finance department and its divisions such as accounts and control, risk management, purchasing, assessors, and tax. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Government from Wesleyan University and a Master of Public Administration with a concentration in public finance and budgeting from the University of Connecticut. Without further ado, we will speak with Ms. Melissa McCaw. This podcast is a project emanating from the Black Woman in Political Leadership class at Cornell University, taught by Professor Carol Boyce Davies. For my first question, tell us who you are and your leadership story. How did you come into leadership?
Sure. So I am born and raised in Connecticut, and I was raised by a single parent mom. She is of British Jamaican descent, born in England and partially raised in Jamaica, and my family emigrated here in the 60s. And so I was raised on the values of hard work, education, dedication, and service. And so I found myself at Wesleyan University for my undergrad. Did not know what I wanted to study when I went to the West, but I was drawn to government studies. It was really a sociology class that piqued my interest, and then I slowly morphed into government. I also loved numbers, and so I took a lot of econ classes, minored in econ. And about my sophomore year, I was involved with an organization called Inroads. And Inroads provides you with an internship that's usually over a 2 or 3 year period, so you can grow in terms of level of responsibility. I really loved that structured environment of being thrown a task, having to use those critical thinking skills, analytical skills, to develop a strategy to answer the question, to do the research into the question, then make recommendations to leadership. And so I loved that. And I stayed with UTC for over 2 years, at which point in my junior year, they hired me to work remotely from my dorm. So I would work remotely to continue that. But I was not motivated by the mission of UTC, you know, the bottom line. And so I was sitting here thinking, what am I going to do with this government degree? But I love numbers. I love analytics. I love critical thinking. And so when I graduated from West, I found myself in my first job was as a budget analyst for the Office of Policy Management, which I did spend about 7 years there. And in that role, I really learned the grassroots, the basics of budgeting and policy analysis in terms of really applying it in a job. I was assigned a series of state agencies. Not only did we build those budgets from the ground up, we had to understand what those numbers meant from an operational perspective. Really gave me the basic insights into, number one, what it meant to establish a budget for an organization. A budget really is a priority document for the organization of what they're going to focus on, how they're going to achieve it. It is more than the numbers on the page, but it provides the tools to achieve that mission. It also introduced me to the legislative side of the three branches of government. Spent a lot of time in legislative public hearings and seeing the debate that would go on. You know, the legislators bring a very different perspective to public administrators because they are bringing the heartbeat, if you will, of the people that they represent. It's a little less rational than just sitting there and doing the nuts and bolts policy analysis and the analytical skills that we're taught in school, because it's emotional. And sometimes the people want something that might not make sense financially, but it's what's driving, you know, the moment, which can also be impacted by the media. So that kind of gave me this rounded perspective. And I had this thing where after I'm somewhere for, you know, a good amount of time, I had a desire to take what I learned. I really wanted to grow and really pursue a leadership position. So I applied for a job and became the budget director at the University of Hartford. That was very different. I did not, I had not had experience in higher education. However, those same principles apply wherever you go when you're in these budget finance roles. The difference is you're picking up a different culture, right? Higher ed is very much a collaborative space. Decisions are made through buy-in. They're not top-down. And so you begin to see the nuances of the culture of an organization, how you get things done. And that, I'd say, kind of diversified my leadership style. It also exposed me to another side of finance. You know, finance has this straight budget and policy and operations track, but then it also has the accounting track. And I found myself supporting a controller who lost their director of accounting, and she taught me the world of accounting. That was very critical to my path, because to be a chief financial officer, you need the budget finance hat and you need the accounting finance hat. I spent about 7 years at the University of Hartford, led them through a lot of change. We had the recession of 2008-2009. Universities felt that because enrollment dropped. Families couldn't afford colleges. And so therefore, we had revenue losses, but we have a fixed structure. We still had the faculty and the benefits and the buildings to maintain, and we lost a lot of our income source. So led the university through a period of rebalancing. And then at that point, I had probably been about, I don't know, 14 years or so into my career. I got a call from, at that point, the newly elected mayor of Hartford, who was looking for a budget director. And I thought, I was, every now and then you need to sharpen up your interviewing skills. So I said, I'm just going to get out there. I haven't interviewed in 7 years. I better get out there and just sharpen these skills up, because soon I'm going to be ready to go for an associate VP position. So let me get out there. So naturally you prepare, right? When I pick up an organization, my goal is to dissect you. And I take their financials and I take their budget and I begin to look at trends. And I look at the growth in cost, the growth in revenues, and I began to pick up on problems. Before you know it, I've red circled all these issues. So I go into an interview and they say, well, you know about Hartford? And I flip open my I'm like, well, you know, you're a, you know, $500 million organization. Your revenue growth is X percent. Da, da, da. You got a problem over here. You've been tapping this rainy day fund. Your IT fund is depleted. Your health insurance underfunded. And by the time I'm done, the next day they're offering me a job. And so that it was a different role, right? I had done state government. I had done higher ed nonprofit. Now I'm talking local level municipal government. And I could see that this organization had problems. I didn't know how bad it was. And I remember one of the vice presidents at the university, he was previously a commissioner for the state of Connecticut. And he said, you know, Melissa, local politics are like a bloodbath. And it's true, because you're so connected to the people that your decisions are impacting. They're very vocal. It's very in your face. And so I had to make a decision at that point whether I wanted to take that leap of faith. And that's part of the leadership journey. The leadership journey, as you grow, you're building your skill set, you're building endurance, you're building all these tools so that as you go into a new organization, you can assess that organization and what tools are going to be effective, because it's beyond my degree. It's beyond my analytics, you know, that you have to be very strategic in how you're going to weave your way to achieve an outcome. And I decided I'm taking that one on too. So I go in, I was really impressed with Mayor Luke Bronin. He had a great background, Yale graduate, very impressive. And I said, you know what? I want to help this leader. And that's another part of the journey. When you're taking on those new tasks, you must assess the leader. You need to be able to align with them, or can you be effective in guiding them? Depending on the circumstances, I knew he was going to have a problem on his hand. Was he going to rely and trust the guidance? And so I felt he was a good character, and I thought that we would make a good team. So I went in. And what did I do? I begin to peel back the layer, right? You've got to go in. You have to assess the organization. And I saw a lot of problems. I saw very large structural deficits that were mind-boggling, quite frankly. And as I began to, no one knew, because they did not have they didn't have the right talent there over time. I think they also didn't have the right leaders to be transparent with what was going on. So I began to pull back the layers. And when the mayor realized it was that bad, we realized we were going to have to go on a campaign. We were going to have to help the people. You had to figure out who are your stakeholders and begin to educate them on the situation and then devise a plan. So that was a three-year journey. We were walking a track of bankruptcy and also working with the state. We were able to restructure. I restructured the city. We cut. I renegotiated every single labor contract and went to arbitration. And we won the day with the state of Connecticut with some additional support because we had a lot of non-taxable property, state-owned property. That was a very interesting experience because it brought visibility. Unlike my other jobs, it brought a lot of media attention. And part of that journey is really getting comfortable in that space, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing when you do your job behind closed doors. It's another thing when the media have that mic in front of you. And can you recite all the numbers or can you think on your feet? Because the media soundbite is all about making sure the right message is caught in that 30 seconds. That was something I had to learn during that time. But it was also a time period where it gave great visibility. We were under state oversight. And so when Ned Lamont was looking for a secretary of OPM, usually what happens is there's a short list compiled and the, you know, the key names in the industry are brought together. And so before you know it, you know, I was having interviews and being, you know, selected to become OPM secretary. And so that's a little bit about the journey of how I've gotten to where I am.
So that was really comprehensive. And I think a lot of the points you brought up were super like important and resonate definitely with me. I mean, you going from, you know, state government to higher ed to city government to state government again really has given you a really rounded perspective and helped you grow within this field. Off of that similar vein, I wanted to ask, are there issues you feel you are able to better address because you're a woman, because of your intersecting identities? And do you ever use like a gender lens when you're addressing like a certain problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, first I would say that this is an industry that is very much when you look, when you walk into the room and you're a government finance professional or a nonprofit government professional, finance professional, It is a room that is heavily dominated by white males. By white men, I should say. Yep, by white men. And then if you do see women, they typically are Caucasian women, and there's a small number of them. So, you know, I started to grapple with that at UHeart when I started to attend board meetings and really trying to get used to being, most of the time, you're the only one. And so I think an individual's walk of life does impact their lens. You know, so I saw that at UHeart. I also experienced it at the city of Hartford. And I had a really, you'll have these experiences in your journey where mentors will kind of speak into you. I had this one, gentleman who was the head of a municipal financial restructuring firm. When you're filing for bankruptcy, you usually, sometimes you will also do a financial restructuring or like a bonded indebtedness restructuring your debt, basically. Well, the guy who led that firm was super duper smart. He was also a West grad, so we connected on that. And he we found myself in the position where when they were getting under the hood looking at those numbers, the CFO at the time, because I was the budget chief in Hartford before I became the CFO, could not answer the questions. So I was helping him along. And so he came into me after about a couple of weeks and he said, "I have to ask you a question. Why are you not the CFO?" I said, "Why do you say that?" He goes, "Because you're the only one who has the answers." And I said, "Well, I don't think I'm ready for that." And he says, "Well, why is that?" Right. And you have to spend some time in your leadership journey to like assess your own self-talk because the industry in my mind did not look like me. So one, I lead from a different perspective. I learned that. And his message to me was, this is your lean in moment. As a woman leader, as a Black leader. And oftentimes for me, I'm the youngest because they tend to be older people, you know, older in these at these levels of jobs. You have to trust that lean-in moment. And that really delves into policy, right? Absolutely, there are issues that I think I could speak better to as a woman. You know, in the state, we're dealing with significant public policy issues. So we did a lot to expand coverage for post-maternity care. We did not cover more broadly as other states, supply surrounding breastfeeding, you know, and so sometimes even thinking about how to structure a press event to, you know, a lot of times when the governor is pitching a policy area, we will strategically plan media events that lead up to his announcement, right? And so planning a media, they'll say, plan a media event with a woman who wanted to breastfeed in public, or they don't, I want to be able to give my child the best healthcare. I can't afford to do it, right? And so the men in the room would not think to do that. But the woman in the room can bring that creativity because of their particular walk. I often find this really coming into place, though, Leilani, in my leadership style. I do believe in empowering woman leaders. When I see someone who's, you know, on a good track, is really just mentoring them to see to it that they grow. I think I have an eye for that because I'm a woman leader and because of my own particular journey. So, you know, certainly definitely use the gender lens. I also use my race lens because at times when you're dealing with policies of equity, you have really smart practitioners. They're book smart, but they don't have the experience, the lived experience. So They might craft solutions to policies that don't resonate necessarily with the Black and Brown community. You know, like during COVID, churches needed to be a part of that solution because for the Black and Brown community, it's a trusted place, right? We had these yellow buses. We're not seeing the movement on our COVID, our testing for Black and Brown and our vaccines for Black and Brown. And we said, we're going to create some buses. We're going to bring them into the community. Everyone doesn't have transportation, et cetera. So some of the solutions that you come up with or that people come up with through the racial lens or through the gender lens, you can say, well, you know what, that there might be a better way to be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Those are some really great points that you made, especially being able to apply those lived experience, being a Black woman on the job is super important. And I also really like the point that you made about having all the answers, but because we as Black women don't necessarily see ourselves in these higher leadership positions, sometimes, you know, we don't want to, you know, go for the top job or things like of that nature. But definitely even just having that one person that said, you know, why are you not the CFO? And you have all this experience and this expertise, you know, is really, I don't say a wake up call, but like we should be in those positions and we are qualified and well deserved to occupy those spaces as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
And you touched upon a little bit your leadership style. I would also like to delve more into that. So you said you always try to empower women leaders and be a mentorship in some capacity. But if you can go more so into what your leadership style looks like, whether that be on a day-to-day basis or more long-term.
Yeah. So I am definitely a strong leader. When I go into lax organizations, that can be an adjustment for them. The reality is that in finance, there are certain principles and best practices that need to be adhered to in order for that organization to be financially strong, whether it's consistent forecasting. You need to monitor your expenses and revenues and forecast it out. You need to have a budget process that has integrity, that looks at the trends. But you also have to manage the side of the ledger that's your cash, right? You have to monitor your bank account. You have to reconcile your checkbook. We don't always balance our checkbooks personally because we're not dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars. But when you're dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars and your job is to protect that asset, you have to close the months, repeat it consistently. You have to reconcile your revenues. You have to reconcile your bank account. Let's just say somebody fraudulently wired $100,000 to their bank account. Well, bank reconciliations help you catch that. They have to be done timely. you monitor your cash balances. And, you know, if you have grants, you need to draw down and get that money back in. I need to make sure by the time I close the year, my cash is in a strong position. I have to monitor my debt position. I need to make sure that I'm paying down my pension liabilities. There are these basic principles, and you achieve financial strength and excellence in the daily commitment to these principles. Mm-hmm. And so that means, first and foremost, my leadership style is we must adhere to financial principles and best practices. So I have to make sure I have a team that is trained, competent, that's capable of performing, and hold them accountable. And so accountability is a part of my leadership style, because at the end of the day, that report card, your financial audit, your annual financial report, and that rating agency report, which is like your credit report, that is my report card and how I'm managing this organization and leading this team. So in this world of finance, accountability is very important. You have to build accountability with development. And so you need to assess your team, make sure they have the tools to grow and to be successful in their roles. You know, in these really tough environments, you also need to make sure you have a workforce that's happy, right? Do they feel empowered in the role that they're in? Are they capable of more? And how do you groom them to get there? What do they want? Where do they see themselves in 5 to 10 years? I don't see my job to keep every employee with me for my career. My job is to help them be the best they are in their current role and grow them into new roles so that they're seeing some career progression. Or maybe that is to grow them to another organization. So I really sit down and have those conversations with the team individually on what it is they want to achieve for their life, for their families. And then we break that down into nuggets. What do these milestones look like? So that part of my job is not just how do we get the daily done to achieve that bigger mission, but while I'm doing that daily mission, what do I need to do to groom that person for their next milestone? And that entails constructive feedback. It's giving opportunity. Sometimes you're doing opportunity with a little push. They're pushing them out of their comfort zone a little bit because I know you've got the goods to do this, right? So you have to encourage, you have to empower, you have to push. And the more you put them into those new environments, just like I've had those uncomfortable experiences, it becomes the norm. It builds confidence and it builds growth. So they probably sometimes feel a heavy hand with some nurturing love behind it, but I try to leave my team stronger than when I arrived at the organization. And ultimately, when I see them go on to higher heights, I know that, you know, I was a small part of their developmental journey.
So you mentioned like managing a team, and you've been in all these super high level leadership positions. So I want to ask, how do you balance your personal life and professional life? And what is your advice to young girls today trying to figure out how they can balance their lives? Myself included, I'm going to be entering the workforce post grad, and I'm definitely, that's something that I'm worried about, work-life balance. So how do you do it?
Yeah. Oh, I'm still struggling with that, quite frankly. They say I have a problem I need to work on, but, look, certainly in the earlier years of your career, it's a little bit easier. You want to really dive in to your area so that you can learn it and master all the different nuances or area of your career industries. I do think in those 20s to 30s, you have a great time to kind of like really put in the extra. So those real intensive jobs, that's a great time. When I hit my 30s, it's when I started to have my children. And that was really hard, right? At that point, I had my first child. I was at OPM. OPM was an environment where you'd work till very late hours of the night. If a bill came out and the governor needed analysis, well, you don't leave until it's done, because by 9 a.m. you're sitting there and you're giving an overview and a recommendation. And so you do have to find those jobs where it gives you enough challenge, yet allows you the flexibility to take care of your personal needs. There is a reality, though, that if you want to grow to the highest levels of your career, I mean, these big director jobs, they're not 35 to 40 hour jobs. They're 50 hour jobs. You know, OPM secretary is a 60 to 65 hour week job. You know, at the time when I left UHeart gave me the challenge And he gave me the flexibility to raise my kids. I didn't have remote work or anything like that. But, you know, when I worked the late night and I needed to leave early, I could flex. It also, you know, had some additional benefit. I had a good boss. So your boss is very important, whether or not they're supportive of you and what you need for work-life balance. You have to articulate that. You make yourself an asset by being the best in your field. They don't want to lose you. They're going to be more flexible. But that was a period of time where that college environment was helpful. They had programs for my children when they were younger, and it helped me to achieve that balance, despite the fact that it required hours. My strategy for me is I need to be home 2 to 3 weeknights. Therefore, I'm going to hit my heavy nights and 2 other nights. I might be in the office till 10 o'clock. Or 11, right? I might start my meetings from home to give me flexibility to get my kids off. And Friday, I'm remote and I will end my day at 3 o'clock. So, you know, as you grow in your career, you can kind of take more flexibility. Your employer gets you more flexibility. But you need to not be afraid to move around a little bit if it gives you the balance that you need and the empowerment that you want from that job, that satisfaction from that job. Because with those different experiences, you become stronger. Had I stayed at OPM for my entire career, I would not be the OPM secretary. It is the diversity of experiences. It's being thrown into these new environments and figuring what skills do you have that you can apply and what are the new ones you need to achieve. That brings a level of resilience and growth in you as a professional that staying in one place does not always provide. So I think that's very important is, you know, knowing your employer, knowing your supervisor, put those hard hours in those younger years so that you can be in a higher level position when you get to the family stage of your life. But know that with the heavier leadership, there are greater expectations. And for me, when I accepted the OPM secretary, that's a job you do for a very short period of time. It's intense. You know, it's hard to do that for 8 years. So your intent is to go in, hit it hard, build your career, build your resume, and you then move on. So during that time frame, I knew that the family was going to make a sacrifice. The family had to agree to that. That was not a one-person decision. That was a family decision because others were going to have to pick up the slack for me during that time. So, you know, there's a little strategy depending on where you're at in your career.
Definitely some key takeaways there. Diversity of experiences. As well as balancing, you know, a challenging position, but having that flexibility as well, I think is really great advice for young girls to hear. For my next question, and you touched upon it a little bit, what is leadership in your thinking and how would you objectively define leadership? And does this definition shift when women are in political power or within certain political structures?
So let's start with what do I think? How do I define leadership?
Mm-hmm.
Leadership is not the position. It is not necessarily only defined by the title. Certainly when you're in the top tier title, leadership is expected, but leadership occurs at all levels of the organization. If you are the head of that organization or department, leadership should set tone. It should set expectation and vision. And leadership is more about how you utilize your team to effectively accomplish a goal. It is also about how you utilize external stakeholders. Who do you need to accomplish the goal? So let's take the state of Connecticut. You have to monitor the environmental stimuli. Who are the key leaders in the legislature? What is their legislative and political agenda? Who are your leaders' allies? Who are the governor's allies? What are the most pressing policy issues of that time frame? What is the media saying? What are the people saying? Is there bipartisan support, right? And so leadership is really a lot about the strategy behind how you achieve a goal or how you lead an organization to achieve a goal, or how you lead multiple stakeholders to get to a goal. So if you want to pass, a policy on tolling, right? Or and what ultimately became the highway use tax, right? You are really strategizing on what the needs are of different stakeholders and how you can get them to align around one vision. And so it is really important in your day-to-day job, you have to build time to stop and do the strategy, to do the leadership strategy, to figure out how you're going to lead an organization. I also think leadership is an energy, right? You can spot leaders from afar. When they're seasoned, you can see that leadership strength and that presence of character. Organizations need that. It's kind of like you need structure. It's like how kids need structure and feel like a strong home. Well, organizations need to feel that too. They need to see you present. They need to understand your vision. You need to communicate with them. You need to hear from them, right? They need to feel like they're bought in to the vision and to the team. And part of your job in being a leader is to make sure that happens. So you also have to build space for that communication. You communicating out, you receiving back from them, and you need to demonstrate that when you acknowledge the team and their thoughts, and that where you can, you've incorporated it. So I really see leadership from multiple strategies, from a presence and a state to how you drive an organization or a group of people or multiple stakeholders, internal and external, to achieve a mission.
Keeping front of mind that leadership is not, just wrapped up in the title, I think is very salient, and that it occurs at all levels. And to your point of leadership being an energy, we spoke a lot in class. So within my class, like every week we cover a really important Black woman leader. So we've done like Rosa Parks, Shirley Chisholm. A common quality amongst all of them is this charisma, and how I think that relates really well to the energy that you're speaking of, that these women, all they have like a certain cadence and aura about them that inclines people to follow them and to want to listen to their ideas. So
you raise Rosa Parks, it resonates. One other thing, leadership can be painful. There's a burden to leadership, right?
Yes.
You take my OPM experience. When you're leading in a political environment, politics is messy and politics is not rational. What you see written in the paper might not be the real deal. But when you sign up to serve in a leadership capacity, there can be pain to leadership. It can be, everyone does not latch on to your leadership style right away if it's a new organization. And in these roles, we're human beings and we too have feelings, right? You see this strong leader up there. That doesn't mean when they go home at night that they don't say, my God, this is brutal. It is like a call. It's a call to leadership. And it takes commitment. It takes a driven person to recognize the good days, the bad days. But when you look back over time, you will see incremental progress, right? And you have to kind of celebrate those wins as a leader. And it's also important, you got to commiserate with your fellow leaders. It's really good for us to have, our own mentoring group. You hear the struggles of other leaders, whether they're women, they're people of color, and even just, male leaders, and hear a little bit about their styles and their own challenges, right? Because it's encouraging, right? So it's very important that you build your circle, because leadership, it has its pain points too. It's these are hard tasks, they're hard jobs, but they're very rewarding in the end when you look back over what you've accomplished.
Dispelling that strong Black woman trope, we covered Harriet Tubman as well.
Yes.
And a lot of what we unraveled in that class was that, of course, she led all of these enslaved people to freedom, but she was a person too. She went through struggles in her personal life.
Yes.
She was physically assaulted, which left her with like a mental disability. Mm-hmm. She was separated from her husband, and even when she was free, quote unquote, in the North, she still had those personal struggles, despite, being seen as like this strong Black woman leader.
Right.
I think like acknowledging that Black women are multifaceted and that they're not just, cannot be boiled down to just one facet of the identity or one experience is really important to cementing Black women leadership, like as a person, like
yes,
in their entire personhood in the future. So
I want to just hit another point, because we talked a little bit about that strong Black woman. Well, when you're in a field where it's mostly men, sometimes as a woman feel like they have to personify that male hardcoreness, right? But you're starting to see women leaders now, you know, that men, women, you'd even see in terms of the woman would always be in the pantsuit, right? Okay. I have to embody or model this image of what it looks like to be in this role. And as you grow, you just become comfortable in your skin and you can rock the red dress with the pearls and bees and the pumps, and you're just as strong. You don't have to fit this image of what, you know, the leadership style of that industry looks like. And people become more comfortable as they grow in their career and bringing your own personality and identity to leadership, right? You don't have to look like the person in the room, you know, the dressing up. Yes, there is a standard expectation, but you can express yourself and still, your voice is still equal and your skill set and your competence can be equal and you're still true to your own self, right? We're seeing that even too in kind of like the Black, Strong Black Woman conversation where like state of Connecticut passed the Crown Act and it's bringing awareness. It's bringing awareness to those environments that people might naturally perceive certain hairstyles in a certain way. Well, those conversations are also happening in spaces like diversity, DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion conversations in jobs. I recently participated in one. And it's funny, you get in that room and nobody wants to talk, but the burden to leadership is I have to talk. Mm. I don't share my experiences. People won't know, you know? And so I think that is the way to change perspectives, is these tangible conversations and some of the legislation that's been passed.
Mm-hmm. Applying those lived experiences are super important. But then also on the other hand, it's like as a Black woman, you feel like the burden is on you because if you don't speak up, mm-hmm. who will?
Right.
And then sometimes you also feel like you're the representative, not just of yourself, but as mm-hmm. for like all Black women or yeah. the Black community. So that's a lot compounding on that too.
Mm-hmm.
For my next question, uh-huh. do you feel that women in positions of power are scrutinized more heavily on issues such as competence, but as you mentioned, issues like physical appearance, clothing, have you had any experience with this and could you give examples?
Absolutely. It's a tough world out there. Quite frankly, one, in some of these careers, you don't see a lot of women. Two, whether you're at the top of the totem pole and that career structure or not, you know, when you have to leave early because you have to pick the child up from daycare, or, you know, if you're the one who has to cook dinner for the kids and you can't stay late, you see it. You don't just see it at the highest level. You see it at the throughout your career versus the male who doesn't have as much responsibility, or, you know, and maybe that's just the way it works in their family. The other thing I would say is that certain tables are just not used to having a woman there, and they're not used to having a woman of color. And so therefore they're not, it takes time to, you have to fight your way to make them welcoming spaces. So that materializes itself in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it materializes when you speak up and you are ignored, when you're spoken over. And sometimes you have to really exert yourself. Like I've been in situations where I say, oh, excuse me, I was not done speaking. And that brings attention to the fact that they just spoke over you. You know, my state of Connecticut experience was very difficult. I was the first Black and female Secretary of the Office of Policy Management. That is typically a role held by a white male. And so I'll tell you, it was a struggle every day. It was a struggle within the executive branch and it was a struggle in the legislative branch. Now, here's what I will say. My level of competence and knowledge, there's no question. It's so complex. So I have to know everything about Medicaid, everything about temporary family assistance, everything about group homes, negotiate a nursing home settlement, know everything about the revenue policy. Like, you either can bring it, you can do that job, or you can't do that job. But whether or not people always want to see that person on the front of it, you can feel that. You feel that in the space. You can feel it in the way you might be challenged in a way that your predecessors were not, or the respect that we're given, or how you're treated. You might have remarks. And so that is a challenge. It is not a reason to stop, because the more that women are in positions of power, it becomes more the norm. I had the great pleasure of co-chairing the first Connecticut Commission on Women and Girls, which was all about empowering women to and girls into positions of leadership. So I choose to rely on my competence when I'm sitting in that seat, and that I'm not going to be shut out. I'm going to bring it irrespective of the environment and irrespective of whether it's initially welcoming. And you know what? When I see those particular individuals that are struggling with that, I'm going to embrace you even more. I'm shaking your hand every meeting. Hello, great point. But you know what? I want to talk to you about this, because you have to bring people together to dialogue, and that helps bring like-mindedness. So that is a challenge. I certainly have experienced it. It is something that I think as women we will continue to face. I think it's even harder for Black women in positions of leadership. And, you know, when we're talking about racial type issues or gender challenges, they don't always materialize in statements like, you're a woman, I don't want you here, or just the most egregious where you can tangibly see it. But the intangible, it's the environment, it's the
microaggressions.
Yes, exactly. And so that is very, and sometimes I will tell you, our own people of color can be challenging as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit more on that? Like with like Black men, like within like the Black community or other marginalized groups?
Sure. I mean, how we achieve equity. So, of course, let's just take a step back. I was the OPM secretary to a Democrat, to Governor Ned Lamont. I also had to represent his position on policies, which sometimes that's your personal position, sometimes you're not. You know, typically we did align. But when you're in that position of leadership, the Black community might look to you and think, every single thing we want for the Black community is what you're going to deliver to us in that role. But my leader had to balance needs and wants across a multitude of stakeholders that elected him into office. So that can be very hard at times to, you know, because we as a people, we look at it and say, we finally have a person of color in that role. Yes, we want to move every single policy, right? And I might have to tell them no. It's hard for them to accept that. And so they might challenge. I can tell you, I was in a hearing. It was right after the George Floyd incident. And, you know, across the nation, people were really, the emotions were high. And I presented a budget that year at every single policy issue. They took me down, but they went to another level in disrespect again, because I think they were looking across the table. And so you're in a public hearing. You are professionally answering questions. But at some point, they were going so heavy, I had to say, are you trying to tell me that the first Black OPM secretary didn't pay for enough equity? And it was not until I had a hardcore type response did they back down. So they, when you have to monitor the engagement style, typically engage with a person in that position. And they just, sometimes they take a little far. So, that's the situation where I was, you know, here I was a person of color, and I was, and then my legislators are people of color, really, really challenging. But then also when you're in a space where you're only surrounded by folks that are not of color, you can also feel you can get challenged in other ways as well.
Mm-hmm. That goes back to your point about having, you know, the competence and the skills and the experience, but still being challenged and treated as if you don't.
Yes.
Which is super unfortunate, but definitely getting more women of color, more Black women into these spaces and making it the norm and you know, demanding that respect will definitely change this leadership for future generations to come.
One other tactic that is often used is they will just exclude you from the critical meetings. So, you know, those are the, you know, the challenges that we face on the games and the in the structure of how work is getting done. So, you know, we have work to do. We cannot measure our success only by seeing women in these leadership roles are women of color in these leadership roles, you have to also measure it by, are they allowed to function and to operate and to deliver the same way a male would, a white male or any male would be allowed to if they were in that capacity? Is their voice heard in an equal way? That's how you measure the progress. So one step is to see the person in the role. The next, a competent person in the role, the next step is to see them be able to be included, diversity, equity, and inclusion, included, respected, heard, valued equitably to someone of that same competence, whether they are male, female, black, white, yellow, green. That's the measure we need to be seeking, needs to be working towards.
And the fact, you know, you're the first African-American woman to serve as Secretary of Office of the Policy Management in Governor Lamont's, you know, cabinet, the fact that we're still having first, so that goes back to, you know, we're in the spaces, yes, but the work doesn't stop there.
That's right.
My last question, I want, in the interest of time and to respect your busy schedule, what advice would you give to the next generation of leaders?
You know, my advice would be that we should be grooming leadership in our kids throughout their educational career. I think it's important to pursue your education so that when those opportunities come up, that you are also viewed as cream of the crop and that you're given the opportunity. And we just have to understand that leadership has its challenges. It's a great privilege and an honor to serve in these roles, not only for your own career, but as a leader for your family and the legacy that you're building for people that come after you. It's, you know, it's, you look at the research says that kids need to see this modeled, because in their psyche, when they see more people that look like them in the boardroom, they it becomes more of a norm that that can be me, you know, that can be me. So, you know, the call to leadership is one that we're changing the mindset of generations that will follow us. We're also paving the way in a different way than Rosa Parks or Harriet Tubman, but we are impacting organizations and helping them to see what women leaders are capable of, and some of the additional perspective we bring to the table, or the mentoring and work-life balance features we bring to that environment, so that you can have a diverse culture. You know, there's research that shows that organizations that have diverse boards achieve better financially. So when you have diversity of thought, you have stronger teams. So, you know, I want to encourage the future generation that the world is yours, and your tablet is a blank screen, because that's what that generation's using computers. Your tablet's is a blank screen. What are you passionate about? What drives you? You want to do something that you wake up in the morning and you're like, I can't wait to get there and do that, and you want to pursue that. And you want to grow to all heights in that area. And it's possible. You know, we will have challenges, but the more progression we see in women leadership, we're changing that environment. We're changing the culture, and we're changing people's perspective of what that particular career landscape looks like. So, you know, I am a fan of Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, you know, if you can't walk, then crawl. If you can't run, then walk, you know, but whatever you do, you've got to keep moving forward. And that's what leadership is. It's about moving forward, both personally and professionally. And in essence, you're having an impact on future generations and on an entire career field.
What a great end note, I think, for this interview. And I'm so grateful that you were able to take the time out of your day to speak with me and really give me some delightful answers. And I'm glad I got to learn more about you, your leadership style, your leadership experience.
Well, it's absolutely my pleasure, and I wish you all the very best. Congrats again on your upcoming commencement, and I'll be Googling you and looking you up on LinkedIn to see what you're doing.